It's Truth About Markets, Max and Stacy. We are in Stockholm, Sweden, with a very special guest, Rick Folkvin, who is the founder of the Swedish Pirate Party, also named last year on a list of 100 top thinkers around the world. Rick, welcome to the program, Truth About Markets, here in London, 104.4 Residence FM.
Thank you, Max. It's great to be on the show. I appreciate you bringing me in.
All right, Rick, I got to follow up on what we were talking about a minute ago, because the residence audience is primarily deadbeat musicians living in their parent basements, smoking dope all day, don't have any kind of gainful employment. But they would find it very interesting, the whole mega upload story, as it relates to copyright, as it relates to hip-hop, as it relates to how to make money, whether you have talent, or in the case of the people who listen to this show, have no talent. Explain a little bit more about it.
Right, Max. What I find very interesting about the Megapolis story is that the copyright cartels are not primarily attacking people sharing music, movies, games, whatever. They're attacking alternate distribution models. What they're scared to death of is not that ordinary people share some music, because teenagers have always done that. What they're scared to death about is that artists will discover that they, as parasitic middlemen taking 95% of the cut, are no longer needed for artists to make a living. Mega Upload had this deal where they would pull in ad revenue. I mean, they had 4% of the internet's traffic. They pull in tons of ads, where they would offer two musicians who would give them a lot of traffic, they would return that favor with 90% of the ad revenue. So a lot of hip-hop artists would find that publishing for free with Mega Upload was a much, much better deal than ever going with the traditional record labels. And that, of course, was definitely a poke in the eye for the copyright cartels. So if you ask me, I think that's why extrajudicial pressure was used to arrest a German citizen running a Hong Kong business on New Zealand soil for breaking a United States law that could be questioned if it were even in effect yet.
All right, so just to recap, the musician would get 90% of the ad sales versus 5% after expenses in a traditional label deal. This is something of a threat to the people that the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, is their lobbying group. They're afraid of the competition, so they have been fighting this tooth and nail. Now, let me ask you about a quote from Neil Young. I'm sure you're familiar with his work, famous American rock and roller.
Yeah, definitely.
He said recently, quote, "Piracy is the new radio." What do you think? What does that mean? And talk about that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with him. I mean, he said the piracy is the new radio. It is how music moves around. And I mean, that it's true. From the days of Napster, people have started to discover that they don't need the copyright cartel to provide them with music, because people share music. Today's hard drives are on the verge of being able to hold all music ever produced, and they're just growing exponentially. So it's not going to be long before we can share anything ever produced. What is a danger is that artists are going to discover that this is actually beneficial to them. And we're seeing that in numbers. I mean, the average income for musicians has risen 114% since the advent of Napster. And that's certainly not due to record labels. If we're looking at that industry, which is not the music industry, but the piece of plastic copy manufacture industry, which is...
Let me cut in here for a second. Right. You're saying that musicians' income has increased by 114% since the advent of Napster.
Right.
This is a story that goes untold because, and I'm guessing here, curious what you think, the same people who support the copyright cartel, the RIAA, the MPAA, are also the biggest influence peddlers in the mainstream media, whether it's the mainstream outlets in the U.S. or even the BBC here in the U.K., they don't want that story out over as a news item either, correct?
To a large extent, yes. Public service is a special case, but if you look at the ownership structure of these copyright cartels, you can see very quickly that it's the same owners that control this old distribution models of culture, whether that culture is news, whether it's entertainment, whether it's music, movies, stuff to read, stuff to digest, stuff to waste time with. And that's, again, why the net, it brings such a different narrative. The old media structures, television, news, and so on, are fundamentally incapable of telling the narrative where millions of people rise up and demand their civil liberties against a dozen of trade representatives. Because in old media, you have he said, she said journalism. You have two people pitting it out against one another. If you're taking your news from the net, you see in thousands of news sources that start to resonate around a common theme, where you don't have a limited number of pages, you don't have a limited number of time, but electrons are recyclable, you have as much space as you want. So, yeah, you can definitely see that there is an establishment trying to preserve a status quo against new distribution models of information, knowledge, culture.
Let me jump in. I'm following up on that news and the news aggregators and the news business as part of the SOPA-PIPA debate, if you will, or the sudden interest in those pieces of legislation. The website Reddit, which is a news aggregator site, suddenly became a lot more popular than it had been because it was unflinchingly reporting on what was going on in this space, and as such, on a competitive basis, earned a lot more users of its service. And again, this is a threat to the old world, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're looking at social news, it's a completely disruptive way of not just reporting, but also in terms of how you take part of information. I sometimes try to tell that to old media that I don't even get their news valuation. When I take part of news, I look for keywords, I look for what my friends say, and I look for certain themes. I don't look at their front pages, meaning that all this work that they put into valuing the news and prioritizing the news, it doesn't even get to me. I don't care about what they think is important. I care about my priorities. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing an individualization of news priorities, which is completely disrupting the entire old distribution model. And Reddit is one of the key players here that allows for this individualization. And it turns out that a lot of individuals resonated around the fact that the net would be neutered and censored in order to basically safeguard the old interests, and people didn't stand for that.
Okay, let's talk about the Swedish Pirate Party for a second. You started the Swedish Pirate Party. What year was that?
It was January 1st, 2006.
Okay, now since that time, it's been replicated in dozens of countries. It's taking on huge significance in Germany. Something like, you told me earlier, the percentage of seats that are held in parliamentary seats by the Pirate Party is pretty significant. I don't know what the number was, but...
Yeah, we took 9% in the Berlin state elections, and it's now getting 14% in polls, meaning that one in seven people in Berlin are voting pirate. I think that's very significant.
Okay, and it's also in the UK. And the UK, yep. The musicians who listen to this, Resonance 104.4, what you're putting forward here is an argument about why musicians would want to join the Pirate Party. It sounds counterintuitive to the people in the audience, but explain that a little bit more, because I think that makes sense. That's what we're saying, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no coincidence that Lars Kay, who's the party leader of Pirate Party UK, is a professional musician. It's no coincidence that Anna Troberg, who's the party leader of Pirate Party Sweden, is a professional, or was a professional author. She's now leading the party full-time. And she used to be a book publisher as well. Two-thirds of our members are somehow creators of culture. And there's a reason that what they're demanding is just for the old monopolies to get out of their way of interacting with fans and eventually get income through that. So we are seeing that the old record labels used to take 95% of the cut in the case you'd even get a contract. I mean, people were dreaming of record label contracts as if it would be the only way of connecting with fans at all. That's not the case anymore. Record labels are not needed. And yet, they're trying to shut down artists' ability to publish, like through the Pirate Bay, through Mega Upload, through alternate distribution channels. And this, I think, is why creators should be very concerned about their future, because monopolies are trying to lock them in. That's what we're trying to prevent.
Okay, so you mentioned distribution there, which is, I think, the word of the year in terms of the pirate movement is that we're moving away from the right to copy, which was really, for the first 10 years, when Lawrence Lessig was really articulating a lot of the issues involved in this particular political cause to now talking about distribution, because the ability now for governments to simply go into people's bank accounts, as was the case with MF Global, and just seize people's money, or in the case of Mega Upload, they simply went going into people's lockers where they keep their stuff, and they're just seizing stuff. So they're acting completely extrajudiciously to just seize private property. It's not free market capitalism. Well, let me ask you this. A lot of people associate this movement with issues on the left, but that's the wrong way to look at it, isn't it?
I think if you're coming from the left, I think you can sympathize with it, but it's not the only way to look at it. If your issue is solidarity, then yes, you will definitely be against corporativist crackdown on the ability to share. But if you're coming from an entrepreneur background, as I am, I mean, I founded my first company at age 16, I had my first employee at age 18, then you're absolutely outraged at companies having this anti-competitive behavior, legislating their place in the market and cracking down on competitors using just the basically we're larger and therefore we have the right of way attitude. They're going in completely outside the law and killing competitors in whatever way they can, lawful or not. And I'm quite outraged about that. And as citizens, no corporation has the right to complain about lack of profits and therefore clamp down on civil liberties. Our freedom of speech has nothing to do with a corporation's profitability.
Let's try to put this into the context of other campaigns that are going on in the UK. Now, in the UK, you have a very successful group called UK Uncut, which has been lobbying for tax reform, getting corporations like Philip Green's Arcadia Group to pay taxes, etc. And, of course, you had the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, which spread around the world. And you had the Arab Spring, of course, in the Mideast and in North Africa. You've got the populist uprisings associated, and again, enabled by technology in a lot of ways, the Facebook revolution, as it's called. Now, suddenly, there's a clampdown on this way to communicate. There's a clampdown on this way to distribute. But in the UK, isn't it the case where if you're a part of a group like UK Uncut, or you're a part of a group like Occupy St. Paul's Cathedral, or Occupy London Stock Exchange, what a unifying cause all these groups could get behind, because copyright and trademark and patent are such a key to all of the ability of corporations to monopolize. Would it make sense for these groups to all kind of rally under the umbrella of this issue and this party to some degree? I know that maybe goes against the idea of, I don't know, what do you think about that?
Now, I'm not going to tell somebody how to vote. I mean, a lot of value in these groups come from being unaffiliated with a particular political party. But yeah, I think there's a definite and significant overlap between the goals of these groups and the goals of the prior party. I mean, if you're looking at a group like Occupy whatever, then you can see that they're concerned about the system being rigged. They're not anti-market, they're not anti-competition. They're absolutely outraged that the system is rigged against competition. So no matter how good products or services they make, they'll never be allowed to make money. They'll never be allowed to climb towards the top. Same thing with, you have musicians, you got groups like the Open Rights Group in the United Kingdom, which also fights for civil liberties at their core. And I think this is where it goes, that the pirate party and the pirate movement is really upset that the system is rigged in favor of the incumbent kings of the hill and their ability to kick away the ladder for people starting to threaten their incumbent status.
Right. And let's see. How much do you want to do?
Well, hi.
Hi,
London.
Herbert.
I haven't said hi yet. We're here in Stockholm suffering from the Stockholm Syndrome.
Oh, boy.
Rick Falkving, how many times do you hear jokes about the Stockholm Syndrome?
Not very often, perhaps, fortunately. I hear a lot more jokes about the snow and how people don't want to live here, and I can kind of sympathize with that this time of year, actually. It's absolutely freezing today.
It's not just absolutely freezing. It's way below freezing.
Yes, it's very much way below freezing. But the problem with that, of course, was Max forgot to bring his winter shoes because it was quite relatively, it's been very warm in Paris. But we're here partly because of the ACTA protests. If you want to tell the audience, by the way, Resonance is a London musicians collective. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's, I guess, the only independent radio station in London. So tell them what ACTA is, what does it stand for, and why is it suddenly, you know, everybody was focused on Pippa and SOPA, and then suddenly all these ACTA laws are being signed across Europe. So why and what are they?
ACTA is a repressive package of legislation disguised as a trade agreement. Its purpose is essentially to clamp down on alternate distribution channels that threaten the Hollywood and RIAA model of distribution. And so I think creators in particular should be very concerned about it. It's got extrajudicial net censorship deeply built into its foundation. It says even that at border controls, it enables customs to search through MP3 players like iPods for unauthorized music. And if you're thinking that your music is going to be free here because you give it away through Pirate Bay and other places, you should choose to do that, I think you should think again, because this is about authorized distribution. And who determines what authorized is? Well, that is going to be the old copyright cartels.
So if I, Stacey Herbert, sing a song and I want to distribute it freely to everybody and say, here, you can take it from Pirate Bay, they're saying, no, you're not allowed to and you can't distribute it that way. We saw that case actually this week in France where Google gives away its maps for free and a competitor who charges a huge amount sued Google in French court, and the French courts decided, yes, that Google's not allowed to give it away for free.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent example of the total disconnect between the new and the old here. I mean, there are serious law proposals associated with ACTA. This might or not come to ACTA itself, about how people should not be allowed to download music from anything other than an authorized source, meaning that if your business model depends on people sharing your music with one another, which, after all, is a great way of getting known, then that's going to be outlawed because it's in conflict with the old copyright cartel model, which just allows you to sell from one point. Essentially, they're trying to kill the net. And there are net censorship clauses, extrajudicial such, in ACTA, that I'm very concerned about and that I think every creator should be very concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So it's really gets back to this idea of distribution, the distribution points, where this is the biggest threat, obviously, because you often hear in Hollywood that the power is with the distributors. You know, you think that the power might be with the talent agencies who monopolize the talent and keep the prices at $20, $30 million per star for a film. But it's really with the distributors, and this is what they clamp onto in terms of maintaining their power base. So if that's threatened, then the whole town gets flushed.
Exactly. I mean, well, what they're absolutely frightened about is that artists will discover that these middlemen are not needed anymore. They can just cut them out of the loop. And that, remember now, that's how a functioning market works. If you have a link in the value chain that turns out is not adding any value to the end service or product, then on a functioning market, that link is going to disappear. The entire copyright industry should already be flushed down the toilet because they are not adding any value. But they have managed to legislate their place in the market. They have managed to sue competitors, disruptive competitors, out of business. And they have managed to scare artists from using alternate distributions that don't take 95% of the cut. In reality, we are seeing that musicians make 114% more money on average since the advent of Napster, whereas record labels are suffering heavily, and that's the best thing that's ever happened to artists, because that means that money is not going through this middleman taking 95% of the cut anymore.
Well, yeah, it seems like the most vocal artists against this are artists involved with heavy metal. And one could argue that maybe we don't need any more heavy metal.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's a much matter of what we need or not. What I'm not prepared to give away are my civil liberties. I mean, copyright monopolies have come to a point where they're not compatible with our fundamental civil liberties, such as freedom of speech, postal secret, reporters' right to keep their sources protected, and so on. Because record labels are now demanding to wiretap the entire net just to see when something unauthorized, in their mind, is going on the net.
Okay, let's
but
get
a private in. Industry has no business wiretapping an entire population. None at all.
All right, let's get into the history of this, whole story. Copyright, and you talked about a book earlier, which I forgot the title.
Information Feudalism.
And the history in the U.S., going back to the car industry, when they had Asian competition, etc. But even going before that, going back to the original copyright laws, it gets into the discussion of private property, which is, of course, going to come up at some point, that I own this private property, I'm entitled to this private property. I was talking to a musician in Paris last week who said, look, I have my house, I bought my house. That's my property. I don't share my house. Okay, so, but this is not a good analogy for a number of reasons. But can you talk a little bit about on this general idea to get this going?
Right. The copyright, one needs to remember, is a monopoly. It is not property. If it were property, we wouldn't need the copyright laws to begin with. Property laws would be enough.
Well, explain the difference there.
Right. The copyright monopoly is a limitation on property rights. If I buy a chair, there's a number of things I can do with that because I hold the receipt to it. It is legally mine. I can put it on the porch for neighbors and charge for it if I like. I can take it apart and use it for new projects if I like. I can see how it's made and make copies and sell them, provided the idea of a chair is not patented, but if it were, that patent would have expired by now. If I buy a DVD in the same manner, now I have the receipt here, I bought this DVD, this is legally my property, there are a number of things I cannot do with this DVD that I can do with a chair because the copyright monopoly infringes and limits my property rights. If I have raw materials, I cannot make a copy of something I observe using my own raw materials that I own because the copyright monopoly limits my right to property. And there are court cases saying exactly this. There was a case in the United States Supreme Court, which lawyers tend to like, saying that infringement of the copyright monopoly is not theft. And this is crucial, that it is not property. It is a limitation on property rights. So seeing that, how infringing on this, I think, very immoral monopoly is actually beneficial to artists, we are gradually learning that it's all about controlling the distribution and controlling the creators, controlling artistry. We're seeing how with weaker monopoly laws, the income for artists is soaring, whereas the income for these middlemen distributors is just going through the floor.
So let's follow up on this. So in other words, let's say I'm a band, I create a song, and I claim property rights on that song. People can buy that song. And as the owner of that song, they can use bits of it. They can, like a chair, they can take it apart. They can do stuff with it. It's theirs because they bought it, right? They bought a copy of it. Whereas through the copyright scheme, the distributor ends up financing the creation of that song or mm-hmm. movie, mm-hmm. and they claim copyright above property right.
Right.
Which therefore, people who buy that song actually are not buying property. They're buying into the copyright scheme as presented by the distributor, whose claims are above and beyond the property right. They're claiming copyright, which makes it illegal to do what you want to do with the thing that you just bought. So you don't really own it, do you?
Well, you do own it, but the thing is that the copyright monopoly takes precedence over your property rights. So it is an active limitation of property rights. That means that you can never argue for the copyright monopoly in terms of property is good, therefore the copyright monopoly is good. If you take that stance, you by necessity, will end up in the opposite conclusion, that if property rights are your goal, then you want to get rid of the copyright monopoly because it limits property rights. Now, this was originally the copyright lobby's first real victory. This was dates back to 1709, when printers and distributors gathered on the stairs of Parliament, begging for their monopoly to be reinstated. The copyright monopoly had lapsed in 1695. And this was an authors, this was the creators, they were saying that nothing would be printed or distributed if they didn't have a monopoly. It was always for the distributors. And where I'm going... Damn, I lost my case.
Well, I'll follow up. So in other words, the machinery of printing books is at the time, pretty expensive. The press, the big presses. So the lobbyists were able to negotiate a legal rights to cover their huge costs. You know, go ahead.
So I remember where I was going with this. Okay. Giving a little bit of silence, you can cut.
Rambling. The people like that when I just ramble incessantly because they're used to that. And most of them are not even listening. They're just taking drugs right now.
Well, it sounds like a good life. But where I was going with this was that their very first victory was classifying this monopoly as property under English law. This was before UK time. Under English law. Because that meant that a judge could not strike this monopoly down. It meant that since it was legally classified as property at the time, then that meant that it had added monopoly protection. And there would be multiple court cases where incessant abuse of power from the old copyright cartels would be used against ordinary citizens. I mean, you would impound printing presses, you would burn books, and it wasn't until decades later that court cases finally put a stop to this by saying that no, authorities may not do something that isn't explicitly given, where it's not explicitly authorized in the laws. So even the first challenges giving us basic civil liberties were court cases against the copyright monopoly. I find that absolutely fascinating. History is just repeating itself over and over.
So the copyright industry is similar to, let's say, the Catholic Church before the Gutenberg press.
Absolutely.
They made the Bible available in various countries to freely copy, freely quote, freely do what you will with.
You're seeing the exact same mechanism all over again. It was, how will the monks get paid when the printing press came? And it wasn't the monks that complained, it was the Catholic Church who were complaining about loss of control over culture and knowledge, loss of control of artistry. They even persuaded kings at the time to gradually ramp up sentences against unauthorized copying, culminating even with the death sentence in France on January 13, 1535, against unauthorized copying. And the fascinating stuff is, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Even the death sentence against unauthorized copying did not work. So I can't really figure out for the life of me what they think they'll accomplish with this censorship bullshit.
Now, one of the ways that this has played out in recent times has been with what's known as sampling.
Right.
Let me just give some background as I understand that as it went down. And maybe we can talk about that famous album that came out, the Grey Album, which was a combination of the White Album of the Beatles and the Black Album from a famous hip-hop star whose name eludes me. But they came out with another album.
Danger Mouse
came out with the Grey Album, but we'll talk about that anyway. So the idea of sampling, which is under fair use anyway, the old copyright regime, it's easy to take a 2 or 3 second bit and put it in a song, let's say, sample it, and you're not violating copyright law. But then when these songs, you know, they used a James Brown sample or a Parliament Funkadelic sample that was so identifiable and such a great hook, then they had to revisit this, and then that became also a revision to the law, etc. Am I on the right court? Help me.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent example of monopoly creep, as in how the monopoly gradually expands and keeps reinforcing itself at the expense of creativity, at the expense of our rights. When it comes to text, you have something called quotation rights. You have the right to quote certain parts under a reasonable length, as long as you attribute the original author. When it comes to sound, when it comes to video, when it comes to audiovisual works, there is no such thing as quotation rights. There is no such thing as fair use in Europe. And when it comes to sampling, I mean, all culture builds on existing culture. There is no such thing as a lone genius. We are all being inspired by what we've heard before. I mean, going from the basic notes on the scale up to beats, up to everything, we're all being inspired of what we hear. So I think we absolutely, as a very temporary measure and start working on this, need to have quotation rights or similar for music, for video, just to be able to remix. And I think that's a very hard point on the Pirate Party's agenda, that you can't outlaw creativity. People today are creating not because of the copyright monopoly, but despite it. Art has become illegal. Mm-hmm. And that's not in creators' interests.
You know, actually, speaking of art and the Kaiser Report, we had Roseanne Barr, mm-hmm. you know, the actress comedian on our show a few months ago, and it became a big story because she said that bankers should be beheaded. Okay,
oh.
So ones that had committed crimes, and. Or she said at least that would be the ultimate punishment if they were found guilty of defrauding and collapsing the entire economy. Of course, it became big news in the U.S. All the news played it, all especially Fox News and stuff like that. Mm. But Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, owned by Viacom, played a clip from the show. So I wanted to post it to our YouTube because, you know, you see an image of Max on The Daily Show.
Right.
So it was like less than 10 seconds. Most of it was our clip. Okay, mm-hmm. Within 30 seconds of uploading it to YouTube, it was taken down saying Viacom owns this clip. And I was like, wait, it's our clip they're playing. How can you take it?
I couldn't play a quote of myself because it played on a Viacom in the meantime, and they claimed rights to me.
Right, and this is one example, right? You have so many examples of independent small artists where the existing monopolies just take down their work by right of being bigger, being the gorilla in the room. And they don't have they can't out-lawyer these gorillas. So it's just being brutish against creativity in terms of having a huge corporate structure. And I think this is not beneficial for creativity at all.
Yeah, you know, the other thing they did, YouTube did, was one of our interviews for On the Edge, we interviewed Miss Shedlock. It was just an interview like this, us talking. Mm-hmm. It was taken down saying Lionsgate owned it.
What?
Yeah. I could fight it, but they said via the DMCA form I had to fill out, and it was very clear in big letters, you are liable for any legal fees, and they could run into hundreds of thousands.
Yep, I know.
And I was like, well, I don't want to even get involved in any sort of U.S. thing,
exactly.
Which could be, so I let them just take it down, even though it's completely our content.
Exactly. I mean, this is what politicians don't get and what lawyers love, right? If politicians and lawyers think that, well, okay, we can let this sort out in court, no problem. If they want to challenge it, we'll just let the court sort it out and everything will come to a fair trial. And what they don't realize, or perhaps pretend it isn't so, is that for an entrepreneur, going to court is losing already.
Yeah.
They don't want to spend time and definitely not want to spend money defending something that is theirs in court. It's often much better business just letting it slip and moving on to the next project. So, well, one thing we definitely need in the copyright monopoly short term is very super clear lines of what is allowed and what is not allowed. And what we also need is a very strong punishment for abuse of this monopoly.
Well, exactly. There was no simple way for me to respond. There was no, like, here, fill out this form and send a note to them saying, obviously, take a look at the material. You obviously took it down from some automated program. This is mine.
Exactly.
There was no way to do that. You had to go through this DMCA thing where you could possibly incur hundreds of thousands in legal fees.
Exactly. And I think, at a minimum, abuse today, there is no disincentive whatsoever to not abuse the copyright monopoly. You take no risk whatsoever. And I think at a minimum, if you abuse the copyright monopoly, knowingly or unknowingly, just like you would do when breaking it, then at a minimum, its penalties need to turn against you. That's only reasonable.
Mm.
Yeah. If you're violating the monopoly by claiming rights you don't have, you're stealing from the public.
Yeah.
You're taking, in this case, it actually is stealing because you're depriving the public of something that the public would otherwise have.
Yeah, even, you know, there was another case. We've had a lot of experiences with this. Is on Facebook, somebody has created a Max Kaiser page.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, not only, he links to his own site, which is maxkaiser1.blogspot.com, and he collects lots of ads. But he's responding to people, a lot of people on his Facebook page, as Max Kaiser. It says Max Kaiser. Mm. So it looks like it's him. But there's no way to stop it unless you do a DMCA. You have to go through their system. You can't just write to them and say, you know, at least make it clear that it's not Max Kaiser, you know?
Yeah.
So okay. I did just publish on our own page and on our website, clearly trying to warn people that it's not Max Kaiser. If you think you're having a conversation with him and he's talking about buying treasuries and silver and gold, you know, the guy's giving out all sorts of advice.
Oh, wow.
But you can only go through this DMCA. That's the only route available.
Right. Now, I think that's also sort of this conflict between the old and the new, that there is this idea that you can centrally control who's allowed to say what. But once you give control to the swarm, the net, of who's who, who's authentic, who's not,
yeah,
things will sort themselves out very, very quickly.
Yeah.
If you look at, again, Reddit, which we discussed previously, then anybody who's not authentic will be downvoted into oblivion in no time.
Yeah.
So Twitter had a different solution to this. They would add verified accounts where, if you look at Obama, for instance, you'll find thousands of accounts named Obama something.
Sure.
But there's only one having this little blue star for authenticity.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
So Facebook might want to do something like that. Or, again, the swarm. Once something comes to a point, the swarm on the net very quickly punishes those who are not who they claim to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Inauthenticity.
Yeah, inauthenticity.
This doesn't work in the virtual world as easily as in the analog world. Hey, you know, that great philosopher Keith Richards weighed in on this topic of the public domain. And he was saying that all of the ideas come from the public domain, and essentially he was arguing that they should return to the public domain, that the whole idea of private ownership of the stuff is inconsistent with an artistic effort. But most artists, or I don't know what the split is, but this idea that there is no original idea, that there is the public domain, it's our birthright because it's part of our cultural heritage as human beings, and that public domain should be kept expanding and kept public. It should not be privatized, because then you're essentially giving civilization, human civilization, you're giving it a corporate-sponsored lobotomy, which we would want to avoid, I would imagine.
Right. I mean, if you look at the copyright monopolies around the world, you can see how they're justified. And there's one justification which stands above all else in clarity, I think, and that is the United States copyright monopoly. It says very clearly that its entire purpose is to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, period. It is not, the purpose is not for anybody to make money. It is not to encroach on the public domain, quite the opposite. It is not to corporativize culture. The only justification for the monopoly is if civilization advances. So locking in culture and knowledge, in my mind, is the exact opposite. So it doesn't achieve the results. You also need to remember that it very clearly specifies the goals. Promote the progress of science and the useful arts. The monopoly is the means. It is never the goal in itself.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, the issue is now becoming a hot button issue. It is becoming a bigger issue. It's as you point out. I think let's talk about this for a moment. Hollywood has for years put out stories about good versus evil. The typical Hollywood narrative, the typical, let's call it the American story, the Superman story, is very simple morally, black and white. But now Hollywood has become the villain, hasn't it? Talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's hilarious. I mean, they've been training us to think in terms of fight over the earth, over civil liberties, save the planet, good versus evil, very black and white. And they've been training us to think in that narrative for decades. And just like you say, the narrative has become Hollywood versus civil liberties. And just as interestingly, the narrative is out of their control because it resonates on the net. It doesn't fit in old media where you got he said, she said journalism, just one representative discussing with another representative. Rather, it's only if you take your news through the net, through thousands of different channels, that you see this narrative resonating. So they've trained us to think in terms of good versus evil, and all of a sudden, and out of their control, they're seen as the villains, the global villains. Mm. And I think quite rightly so, if you look at their behavior.
Well, certainly during the McCarthy period in the U.S. and the blacklists that were developed against Hollywood writers that were claimed to have sympathies outside of the U.S., this went on for a while until a couple of brave Hollywood souls, I think Humphrey Bogart was on the list, who kind of stood up to McCarthy. And, of course, you had the journalism of Edward R. Murrow, who was fighting tooth and nail against McCarthy. And but initially, the entire media went with this witch hunt, with McCarthy, because they saw it as self-preservation. Nobody was willing to stand up. So the Hollywood story broke down for those few months until finally somebody got a spine. Is it going to take somebody from the major media to stand up now and claim foul on the distributors and just point out that basically commit career suicide? That's what we need at this point. Is that going to happen?
Well, you do reach a tipping point, Max. I mean, the net is already in agreement that these monopolies are bad, at least as they are written. If you're asking various people, you'll get different responses as to how far they'll be dismantled. But everybody is in agreement pretty much that they're bad as written. But the net is not old media. And they'll keep being in dissonance for quite some time, I think, until you reach a tipping point where you see enough millions speaking out against this, when it becomes, like you say, a safe career move just to report on what is happening on the net. And once you report on what is happening, then you can start analyzing that and perhaps break the spell, if you like, that these monopolies have incurred on old media.
Now, what about we read now that Twitter, Google, Facebook are going down the path of country-specific censorship laws? So this sounds like bringing more censorship to the web. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that's absolute bullshit. This is not what Twitter users stand for. This is not what Google users stand for. Bringing country-specific censorship breaks the whole idea of a global communications network where everybody's an equal. I mean, I'm a rich, middle-aged, white male No, I'm not rich, but I'm in the rich parts of the planet, at least. I'm in Europe. And the idea that my voice is worth just as much as a young schoolgirl in Paraguay who just had her first laptop under the One Laptop Per Child program, I think that's absolutely fantastic. The net is the greatest equalizer that mankind has ever invented.
But they're kicking the ladder out, to use your phrase. Now,
exactly.
That they become the billionaires.
They are. And I think that these net companies have a very important social responsibility to stand up to repressive government and flip them the bird rather than succumbing to their demands of dismantling freedom of speech. And they're not taking their responsibility. When Google pulled out of China rather than allowing its search results to be censored, despite losing thousands of jobs, the Google sign in China, where people were being laid off by the thousands, was just covered in flowers. People loved them for it. And I think that's the kind of corporate responsibility that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. But let's for a moment play the devil's advocate here. So if, in fact, there is no check to the creeping copyright cartel's clampdown on speech, innovation, creativity on the Internet, where is this all headed? Is it a dystopian nightmare that we see happening here? Unfortunately, a whole lost generation? Or is there going to be some counter story emerging? Sounds bad already.
It does sound bad, doesn't it? And frankly, if you want my worst case scenario, we're heading towards a revolution and a European Spring, if you like. But there are many steps left on that path. We're already seeing abuse of power. We are seeing corporate inaccountability. We are seeing people who don't care about if they're breaking the law because might makes right. And at some point, we're very rapidly approaching a boiling point for this. I'm seeing people saying that if they can get away with anything and I can be arrested for doing nothing, then what's the whole point of trying to follow the law? And my hope is that we'll be able to resolve the problem politically before it reaches that boiling point. And I'm working very hard with a number of colleagues to make that happen. But I think that Hollywood and their ilk are quite unaware that they're up against millions, possibly a billion, of Western citizens that will rise up against clamp down a freedom of speech eventually if they don't back down.
All righty.
We have about 6 minutes left here on The Truth About Marcus. I'm here too, you know, Stacy.
That's right. That's right.
And so you say 10,000 are expected at tomorrow's protest in Stockholm against ACTA?
It's kind of hard.
Oh, actually, we're pre-recording this. So right. Saturday, there will be 10,000.
10,000 have said on Facebook they're coming. Another 3,000 or 4,000 have said they may be coming. Now, this being Facebook, it's kind of hard to predict how that translates into actual feet on the ground at the rally. But just having 10,000 commit to coming, whether they actually do or not, is quite big. And if just 1/10 of those do show up, we're going to fill the plaza. If 1/4 show up, we're going to overfill the plaza, and that's going to be something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to try to be there. It's going to be cold. I may have to get another pair of shoes.
Yeah, that's one thing you learn about holding rallies in February in Sweden. You don't make 5-hour rallies. You don't make 1-hour rallies because people really freeze. And media, being smart, realize that, hey, if we stay for half an hour, 90% of these people will have left, and we'll take our pictures then if we want this rally to be portrayed as not very significant.
So you're saying Stockholm's the original home of the flash mob, because it's just so cold.
Very eloquent. You could definitely say that winter rallies need to be flash mobs.
That makes sense. I can go for that.
So there you have it. We found the origin of the flash mob. You think it's like some cool groovy thing of like getting together for 10 seconds on a platform at the metro stop? Nope. It's all because it was too cold in Stockholm to gather for too long.
I remember European Parliament has this saying that there's a reason that revolution mostly happens in warm countries.
Yeah. Well, or countries with lots of vodka, like Russia.
Yeah, I think most countries have a history of moonshine, though.
Hey, has Sweden ever had a revolution? I know you guys were imperial and ruled viciously my own country of Finland. But I know the UK, where we're reporting right now, is they've had a few failed revolutions. They always stopped once they were in the presence of the king or the queen. But I know you still have a royal family here.
Yeah, I think the closest thing we've come is something called the Bloodbath of Stockholm. Way back.
That's a bit of a Bloodbath of Stockholm.
Yeah, it was called that, but really it's not what you'd call a revolution. Rather, it was a cleansing of disloyal nobility.
The opposite of what you would normally think. So they were disloyal aristocracy, nobility?
Yeah, I mean, it was... I'm not too familiar with the details. Perhaps I should know this, but it hasn't really had a bearing on my personal life.
Yeah.
But there was a conflict between different lines of royalty, and the winning one essentially cleaned the room with the supporters of the losing one.
That's what Max and I predict is going to happen with the financial nobility, a war between the billionaires versus the millionaires. So some guy with only $500 million, as we saw with MF Global.
Or Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, they were taken out. MF Global taken out. So it's a war going on.
Right. Other than that, Sweden has a very proud history going way back into the Viking ages, generally going by its own. I mean, I live in Sollentuna, just north of Stockholm, and just 5 minutes walk from where I live, I can see the hill where they pulled up the ships going up to Birka, coming back from their trade routes. Seeing this history, I mean, the shield of the city even has this ships rolling on logs overland into the old capital, the old Viking capital, just where I live. And we're frankly quite proud of that ancestry and heritage.
Yeah, we think that's how Max's background started, as a Viking Norse lord sort of thing, but that'll be for some other day. Actually, for my film on Pirate My Film, who the heck is Max Geiser?
Oh, that's going to be an excellent film. And this, we got a lot happening on piratemyfilm.com. How much? We got about 30 seconds left?
Yeah, about a minute. So.
Oh, well, yeah, the piratemyfilm.com is going to challenge the Hollywood copyright cartel by crowdfunding projects using Creative Commons copyright instead of the traditional copyright. And also we got a lot of other goodies planned, like dividends to people who contribute to these projects. And we're also putting in Bitcoin, which is a great way to get money around that cost almost nothing to do. So a lot of good things happening with Pirate Money.
And for people who want, you can still, if you choose, you can pay with PayPal and give over 5-7% of your transfer if you want.
Yeah.
Some people prefer those monopolies, but you know, you could do it for free with Bitcoin. Okay, so this has been great being with Rick Falkvinge.
Thank you for having me on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great, Rick. We'll have to have you on again soon. And until next time, this is Max and Stacy saying bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.